Hello, this is Dean Kernut, and welcome to the Alpha Exchange, where we explore topics in financial markets associated with managing risk, generating return, and the deployment of capital in the alternative investment industry. A near 30-year career in markets has given John Haweis exposure to just about every strategy across the spectrum of asset markets. A freshly minted Wharton graduate with a major in engineering, John came upon O'Connor Associates in the early 1990s, where he cut his teeth trading listed currency options. Pre-Euro, John would experience seminal FX vol events like the ERM unwind, tequila crisis, and the Asian contagion episode, all helping him gain an appreciation for the impact of positioning on currency vol surfaces. As his career progressed, John would manage arbitrage strategies, focusing on exotic options, convertible bonds, cap structure and muni bond arbitrage, and dispersion trading. Our discussion brings to life the lessons to be had from trading through periods of market crisis, including the importance of counterparty risk and the degree to which asset prices can stray from fundamental value. We also dive into the vol risk premium, exploring its attributes and how it has evolved over the years in light of the heavy hand of central banks. In a world of exceptionally low rates, John worries about the glut of yield-chasing capital in private credit and the potential that valuation distortions have resulted. Today, John is CIO of DGV Solutions, a firm he founded to offer customized investment management products in a transparent and cost-efficient way. His firm deploys its expertise with a purpose, partnering with clients who have inspiring missions that John and his team feel very connected to. Please enjoy this episode of the Alpha Exchange, my conversation with John Haweis. My guest today on the Alpha Exchange is John Haweis. He is the founder and CIO of DGV Solutions. John, it's great to speak to you today.
It's great to be with you, Dean.
Lots for us to cover. You've been in the derivatives markets for quite some time, I think even longer than myself. And so you've seen not just incredibly low vol periods and incredibly high vol periods, so market wars, so to speak, but you've also seen just a tremendous evolution in terms of technology, the manner in which capital is allocated and committed. Take us through the early parts of your career. We'll kind of use that as a chronology to walk through some of the kind of seminal events that you've traded through. What were the early days like for you in your career?
I was incredibly fortunate. I actually got an engineering degree from the University of Pennsylvania, and somewhere in my senior year, I was doing a senior thesis with a graduate or a PhD student there where we were trying to spin superconducting films onto an inert substrate. And I came to the realization I didn't want to spend my career doing that. And so one day at a job fair, I was walking down the hall and came across a guy from O'Connor and Associates, which was a great option trading or derivatives shop back in the day. And he happened to be an engineer and convinced me to go through the interview process. So I ended up getting a job completely away from engineering, but it was fortunate in that that was a period of time when the financial markets were going through sort of a transformation into a much more quantitative realm. And O'Connor was sort of at the forefront of that. So I got that job. I started trading currency options on the Philadelphia Stock Exchange floor and then moved to the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. During that time, O'Connor had been acquired by Swiss Bank Corporation in 1993, 1994. And that was a great sort of transformative transaction where O'Connor had all this expertise of trading derivatives and risk managing portfolios of derivatives. And it was sort of a reverse takeover. The O'Connor people spread out over the globe, taking over many of the trading functions for this sort of giant AAA rated Swiss bank. So incredible learning process. Trading on the floors, you didn't trade implied volatility per se, you traded premium. And I think that was one of the great lessons of that time is learning what those ticks are worth and that implied volatility can sometimes just be a little misleading. You can sell a very far out of the money put for a very high implied volatility and not take in very much premium for it. So understanding the true value of what you're selling in a premium terms was a great lesson.
So these are really interesting days, the 90s. You're pre-Euro, so you had so many more currencies, some of which were higher yielding, some of which were lower yielding. I think that's some of what you're pointing to. early lessons from that period for you in terms of being on the premium intake side versus premium generating side? What was from the philosophy of how to manage a book of options? Was it more market making, or was there kind of a philosophical bent from the firm as to whether to be long or short vol?
Yeah, so you're right. I mean, it was, first of all, currencies in the 90s was a fantastic market. I mean, you had the ERM exercise at the beginning of the decade, 92, the UK exits the project. So you had sort of that devaluation of the British pound. Then you get into 94, you had the big interest rate back up. You had the Valentine's Day massacre. A lot of things happened in 94, the peso crisis. You also had Japan, I think, you know, as it relates to the current era, enter into quantitative easing for the first time in sort of the modern era. And then you had the 97 Asian crisis, 98 long-term crisis, 99 the euro comes in, and currencies, I would say, got a lot less interesting once you took so many currency pairs out of the marketplace with the introduction of the euro, but really just phenomenal. And I think some of those lessons we all rely on, say, some form of the Black-Scholes model. And, you know, one of the fundamental premises there is that you have continuous pricing. And when you see something like the pound get ejected from the ERM and it's non-continuous pricing, those were incredible lessons to learn. And also the quantitative easing in Japan was really a big transition. So you had the yen had strengthened from 200 to the dollar down to 80 or 85 to the dollar. And then they come through this quantitative easing plan. And there were some big speculative trades put on dollar bullish, yen bearish. So if the yen was at 85 to the dollar, there were huge numbers of par, $100 calls, yen puts bought. And that totally distorted the volatility markets. What had gone from being a 10 or a 12 volatility pair, all of a sudden you had 1 year dollar yen vol trading in the 20s for a period of time, and dollar yen proceeded to rally off those lows up to 140, 145 before everything sort of went pear-shaped in 1998. So some great lessons, and I would say even some comparisons, which we can talk about outside asset classes, but the flow of capital into technology growth at the end of the 90s, I think there's some similarities to today. You know, you see tremendous outperformance of growth stocks over value stocks here the last decade, tremendous amounts of money going into private capital, venture capital, growth capital, private equity, et cetera. And so just exactly, we're probably not as distorted as we were in the dot-com era, but I do think there's some incredible misallocation of capital going on today that will probably result in some poor returns prospectively.
Why don't you walk us through, so you mentioned the tech bubble. I want to say that you had started at a hedge fund. Was it EBF during that period, or was that a little bit post that period? Walk us through the kind of points in your career up to founding DGV.
Yeah, the first 10 years was great. O'Connor acquired by Swiss Bank. Swiss Bank merged with UBS. So really got to understand macro markets, I'll say, trading FX and short-term rates that are related to FX. And then did a pivot, left a big bank, came to work for a hedge fund in Minneapolis called EBF and Associates. And EBF, for those days, early 2000s, was a big hedge fund. You know, I think we had $4 billion under management, and which sounds quaint by today's standards, but that was probably one of the 50 largest hedge funds in the world at the time. And so pivot and become bottoms-up manager, doing convertible arbitrage, some vol arbitrage, but a lot of the classic relative value trades, capital structure arbitrage, fixed income relative value, distressed, things of that nature. So that was a great change. And then a group of us left EBF to do very similar thing. We started a firm called Interlochen Capital Group and did that global relative value trade from 2006 to 2012. So that was a great learning experience, understanding how credit ties in with volatility, how the asset class arbitrage, you used to be able to effectively arbitrage the Wall Street banks. You could call the options desk and sell them single stock vol at 25, and you could buy a convert and hedge out the credit and buy vol at 15 or something like that. And then, you know, things became more efficient. The banks started putting those desks together, and that arbitrage certainly shrank. There was also, after the tech crash, 2000, 2001, a lot of money from institutional investors flowed into these market neutral hedge funds, which were knocking down pretty good returns, call them low double digit returns, that looked great because they weren't correlated or very lowly correlated with equity markets, which had fallen apart after the tech bubble. So it was a great period of time for that particular business, and I was fortunate to be a part of it.
Well, we would be remiss not to chat a little bit about the financial crisis. So I want to dive into some of your insights there. It sounds like you had lots of different exposures. And of course, when you have a crisis, they all like to say correlations go to one, but that's not exactly the case. There's some funky stuff that occurs when vol explodes. But one of the things you said, I just wanted to touch on, but in the pre-crisis period was sort of the advent of capital structure arbitrage. And as you say, the Wall Street banks, for their lack of communication across the desks, were kind of sitting ducks. And I remember things like Tyco, underlyings like GM, where the puts seemed sky high in price, but maybe not high enough because there was a almost insatiable appetite from this cap structure arb investor who would buy put and sell CDS. So it was a fascinating period of time to see this new source of demand for optionality in the wings and in long-dated options that was effectively playing the credit risk versus the vol risk.
Yeah, that was one of our favorite trades back then. You could buy very lowly struck dollar price puts on whatever, name it Tyco, Calpine was a popular name. You know, if the stock was at 30, there wasn't a lot of premium in the 2.5 strike or 5 strike puts. And you effectively set up cheaper credit hedges than what you could do in the high yield market or the credit default swap market. And you had that sort of capital structure kicker, meaning if there was a bankruptcy and you assume the stock went to zero or some de minimis value that might be granted to the stockholders on a reorganization, you had that optionality of my puts can pay out and perhaps my bonds on the other side ultimately recover par as well during the restructuring. Or maybe they survive, but the stock goes to you own the 5 puts, the stock goes to a dollar, your bonds pay par and your hedges on the equity side go out worth $4 in the case of a $5 strike put and the stock goes to one. So there was that sort of hidden optionality in there as well as providing great credit protection on the downside. And there were a lot of inflated capital structures in the early 2000s. Think about some of the names that had just had this equity bull market bubble mentality, and they went down 90%, and then they went down another 90% from there.
As the lean vol years of 04, 05, 06, and even into 07 just dragged on and credit spreads got to all-time tights, what was it like for you guys managing risk and obviously very focused on option-based relationships, whether it's in CDS or in specific aspects of volatility? What were the signs to you and your team that things were not normal and potentially that this was not a VIX of 40 type of crisis, but something entirely unique?
We were, I'd say, somewhat fortunate. We spent a lot of time looking at the highly leveraged financials, and some of it was a product of self-preservation. You look at your counterparties, and back in those days, we used ample amounts of leverage, and we traded with, 19 counterparties around the world, everybody from the money center banks in the U.S., but also European banks and Asian banks and things like that, because we did a lot of arbitrage activity in non-Japan Asia. And so you end up dealing with Bank of Taiwan and things like that. So you've got this counterparty risk out there. And we watched during that period of time, the bank balance sheets just explode. So they go from 20 turns of leverage to 40 turns of leverage. And that was just kind of what you could see. And new derivatives books held more than that underneath. And at the same time, the credit protection got cheaper and cheaper. So I remember buying, we were buy huge amounts of Citigroup subordinated protection for 10 basis points a year. You could buy $100 million of protection and it wouldn't cost you very much to carry. And we bought a lot of that. And I would say that was also one of the great lessons of the crisis. A couple of things as it ties into the volatility markets was those counterparties were very fragile, but you had to be really thoughtful about where you put those hedges on, meaning you don't want to buy Lehman Brothers protection from Lehman Brothers, because if, you know, when you need it most, Lehman Brothers isn't there to pay off that claim. But given what happened to all the banks, that protection, the subordinated protection on Citigroup ultimately traded over 2,000, but it was very challenging to monetize because none of the banks, they were under strict orders. Cash doesn't go out of the bank. There's sort of a run occurring. So they might say, oh yeah, we know that we quoted that 2,000 bid for your credit default swaps, but if you're doing a closing trade, we'll bid you 500 or something like that. So then you have to look into novating or putting on a new contract with a counterparty that you're terrified that they're not going to pay you on the current contract. So that was a great lesson, and I would say influenced our thinking today. We do very, very little investment over the counter. We love the exchange listed products. They were largely bulletproof in the crisis. If you bought an S&P 500 put and you saw it on the screen, you could sell it. There were ample buyers of that S&P 500 put, whereas if you own credit default swaps with one of the banks, very difficult to monetize and very frustrating. The other lesson is the difference between explicit long option profiles and implicit long option profiles. So some of the trades you would do in fixed income, for example, like we used to do a lot of municipal bond arbitrage, and it was effectively a yield spread. So in those days, let's say you have a 35% tax rate, and most of the AAA munis were insured, or they were critical services. They were water or transportation or something like that in municipalities, or they were general obligation bonds at the states. And so if that municipal bond was yielding 90% of its taxable equivalent, a taxable U.S. investor would much prefer to own that AAA debt than the taxable equivalent. And that should mean revert back down to a 65% of the yield and a 35% tax rate. And you would certainly say nobody would ever buy a taxable bond that was yielding less than a tax-free bond. But when the deleveraging occurred in 2008 during the crisis, those AAA munis ended up going out to 170% of their taxable equivalent yields. So that implicit bounding condition of sort of one for one, it ended up going like a hot knife through butter when things broke, or you saw LIBOR spreads collapse through Treasury spreads. And thinking of LIBOR as a proxy for a AA bank risk kind of intuitively doesn't make sense. You say the banks are all in trouble, and yet LIBOR, the swap market, has lower yields on it than Treasuries. I think that was something that was a great lesson, is that they say markets can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent, and particularly with leverage. Once some of those relationships broke, you just said, I don't know where this can go. Who's to say that AAA tax-free bonds are yielding 170% of their taxable equivalent? Who's to say they can't go to 250%, even though it didn't make any sense? Until that deleveraging exhausted itself, there was just some remarkable price dislocations.
You got a couple of great things there. One is just this notion of liquidity, and it kind of comes and goes. We've seen these periods where the differential in pricing between the exceedingly liquid instrument versus something that's slightly less liquid can actually become very substantial. I'm remembering back to LTCM, and it was the 30-year on the run treasury versus the 29.5-year treasury. And even that spread of two assets that are as alike as could be blew out. You also pointed just to the listed market, and I would really underscore the degree to which the listed options market in the US really held up and provided critical price discovery and risk transfer during an incredibly challenging time. And my view has always been that if you have a position on, especially if it's some version of a hedge, you should be able to see it and blow out of it as quickly as you can, as you desire. And so the ability to monetize the listeds, I think, really provided great value to folks. The other point you made I thought was really interesting, and I think it kind of ties back to some of what you were saying on the currency side when you were talking about the capital that was being deployed to buy, let's say, out of the money puts on, I believe you said yen, and just the way in which it was impacting the vol surface. And it was almost the flip side with credit in the period leading into the crisis, where credit spreads were going down because there was so much pressure of people competing to generate carry. There was an avalanche of capital pushing vol down, which is quite the opposite of what you said on the yen side. And I think that's quite interesting. I'm wondering, maybe if we fast forward to present day, do you see anything like that? I know you've done some work on the systematic vol selling industry. Maybe we can chat a little bit about that. But what's the impact of just the force of capital in terms of how option vol surfaces have set? What are your views on that?
Yeah, I think that's important. Is some of it, so I had this experience of managing yen products in the mid-90s, and as they undertook zero interest rate policy and then did quantitative easing. And so you saw that. I mean, I never would have imagined that you'd see it around the world to the extent that we've seen it, and seen Japan just go hyper on this, where they buy not only JGBs and long-dated JGBs, but they're buying ETFs and REITs and really distorting the price mechanism with their involvement in Japan. But having lived through that and seen it, and seen initially when JGBs approached zero yields or very low levels of yields, and you saw credit spreads there come down. And in some ways, it's rational. If you say you're an investment grade credit in Japan and JGBs are yielding 50 basis points, well, who's to say 75 basis points for a BBB credit is unusual? You're picking up 50% more yield, or high yield might be yielding 2%, which you say sounds crazy when high yield defaults at 4% a year on average. So I think this central bank activity as it spanned the globe, and the U.S., frankly, I think did a lot better job than most of the other central banks, meaning we never took our nominal Fed funds rate below zero. I think that has and continues to have some distorting effects. Then you see it in the European banks, which are really struggling to this day. But it's natural that all risk premiums come down. Start with investment grade credit, go to high yield credit. We've talked earlier about this arbitrage between credit spreads and out of the money puts. So it certainly is an arbitrageable relationship between the volatility surface. So it makes sense. I think at the heart of it is central bank policy. I think it probably ends badly, but it can go on for a very long time. It's been going on for 25 years in Japan and has done nothing but grow. And if you travel to Tokyo and you look around, you're like, okay, quality of life in Japan is still very high. There's longevity, the important things. And you'd say, but gosh, the monetary policy and the fiscal policy is kind of freakish, the way that's played out. Could that happen where it takes 25 or 15 more years before something goes horribly wrong? That's a big concern, because I think it causes a misallocation of capital as people are searching for yields of various types and understanding that. And 2018 was a good lesson of people who got out over their skis in some of those trades. The VIX short that some players were running with copious amounts of leverage, and there were some iron condor players that were using significant amounts of leverage that got whipped pretty good in December. Nothing wrong with, I think, either of those strategies, but when you're pressing that bet and pressing it with leverage, and things can snap. So I think it's driven by central bank activity. It makes sense that risk premiums of all flavors are lower than they would be. I still think they're positive, and I still think a lot of risk premium strategies offer good return prospects. You do have to understand the risks, and your implementation style is really important.
I'd love to get your views on 2017, because it was, as you mentioned, a precursor to a couple of blowups, but both of which were very different. One, the XIV event in February of 18 is kind of an unwind of a very, very crowded, somewhat toxic product. And it certainly had spillover, but eventually the market recovered and had a very, very soft summer in terms of volatility. It was market kind of meandered sideways. And then late last year, things got pretty volatile for maybe different reasons, but certainly volatile. In 2017, we had this realized vol of, I think it was about 6.5 in the S&P. And one metric I've gone to is the realized vol on the down days. If you just look at the days the market moved down, the realized vol was about 6.5 as well. Really remarkable stuff. So I'm curious if you can share some of your views on what happened there. What do you think are the causes that conspire to make volatility so low? And then just for comparison, in the pre-crisis period, let's call it 2006, the height of the bubble, realized vol in the S&P was 10. So 35% lower in 2017 than 2006. What do you think was going on during that period?
Yeah, 2017, you touch on it. I mean, a 10 VIX environment is certainly low, but not unheard of. If you're around in 93, I remember our index guys buying SPX vol in single digits, and you couldn't make money owning it for a couple of years there. And then things broke loose in 94. And then again in that 2005, 2006, that great moderation period. So in 2017, I think a little odd because your realized was substantially lower. Let's just say if the VIX averaged, I forget, 11 or 11 and a half, and to come in with realized at 6.5, that volatility risk premium's extraordinarily high. But simplistically thinking of the VIX as an applied volatility measure and what your subsequent 30-day realized volatility is, usually it's very consistent no matter where you start, and it's about 20% less. So if the VIX is 10, you usually realize 8 historically over the subsequent 30 days. And if you start at 20, you usually realize 16. And if you start at 30, you'll realize 24. So it's about 20% less than that on average. The odd thing in 2017 was VIX average is 11.5 and realizes 6.5. So that volatility risk premium was extraordinarily high. It was probably a little surprising in that the fundamental drivers of volatility, and I know Macro Risk Advisors has done some work on this with your VIX model of different inputs of economic growth, where are credit spreads, some different inputs you can do with this sort of macroeconomic model to proxy the VIX with pretty good correlation metrics. And I think 2017, surprisingly, because the Fed had started raising rates and started quantitative tightening, and all those things should have filtered through more quickly. And I think it finally took until 2018 for it to snap, was liquidity taken out of the system slowly but surely. It's like ice on a lake in the springtime. When do you finally get to the point where it's fragile enough that you break through? And I think that was 2018's business. I think it's really interesting macro perspective looking at Fed policy. And Jay Powell is always very clear to point out that the Fed has been given this dual mandate by Congress of full employment and stable prices. Full employment, I think we look at it today and you say 3.6% unemployment, that's the lowest rate in 51 years. And I think we're clearly there. Stable prices, how do you define that? For some reason, we've come up with this sort of arbitrary 2% inflation to be stable prices. Why not 1? Why not 3? Why not 0? And if you look, core CPI, I know the Fed prefers PCE, but core CPI is 2.3% year over year. And yet you've had this incredible pivot this year where the Fed's lowered rates by 75 basis points. They're doing a form of quantitative easing again through the repo channel. And so you look at the Fed's balance sheet in the 21 months through June, while they were doing the quantitative tightening, they took the balance sheet from $4.5 trillion to $3.75 trillion. Well, they've added 40% of that reduction back on just in the last 2.5 months. So some of the volatility dampening I think we've seen here is it really directly corresponds to central bank. And the ECB lowered rates by 10 basis points here a few months ago and started 20 billion euros a month of quantitative easing again. So I think some of that is just, it's amazing how quickly that mechanism works and how vol dampening it is. I think 2017, it was just kind of like, when is this going to happen? You're seeing liquidity being withdrawn. You'll see the monetary tightening. When are we going to fall through the ice? And I think you saw it in the vol event in February, but then in the fourth quarter, the market. And I frankly think that's what scared the Fed. You see a 20% fourth quarter correction in equities. You normally don't get those 20% moves unless you're staring recession right in the eye. And then you saw the yield curve invert. And I think they said, okay, we're going to take these market signals, even though our dual mandate, inflation looks fine, employment looks fine, but we got this stock market signal, we've got this yield curve signal, we've got to change our monetary policy, and they moved into this aggressive easing stance. And I think that's why you're seeing vol today. I just looked, I think 30-day S&P vol's 5.7% this morning. And so the air has come out of the risk premiums quite quickly again.
You make a bunch of points there, and one of them I picked up on is just around who's driving this bus. And I would really concur that the degree to which the market in some ways forced the Fed's hand so aggressively pricing future cuts that the way I framed it is it would be a de facto tightening not to follow what the market is priced in terms of the short dated part of the yield curve. And of course, the Fed did find itself in a position to do that and did, and it might have been the right call. We'll see on all this. You also make the point during 2017 that the Fed was tightening and that it was interesting that the impact ultimately wound up coming in 2018, even as 2017 they were tightening the whole time. So these lead lag effects are always so uncertain. I'm curious on the 2017 low vol period, because there was, we said 6.5 realized for the entire year. I think in December, we probably realized about 3% or so. It was remarkable how sideways this market was. And one of the narratives, and I've struggled with this, but it's a strong narrative and it may well be correct. I just find it very difficult to verify, was that the dealers were being stuffed with gamma, very short dated, very near the money risk premia programs that were trying to harvest this spread that you say. VIX of 11 may sound low, but if the realized is 6.5, it's not that low. And there's a chance to try to incrementally add return in this very low interest rate environment. Do you think that the dealers' hedging activity was itself a form of reducing the vol? Have you been able to get a strong view on that?
Yeah, I think there's been some impact, right? There's clearly more systematic vol selling strategies in the market today than there were 10 years ago. When you look through it, and there's variations on themes, we have a fund that does purely put rights. But I would say the bulk of the activity comes from accounts doing buy rights. And there are other forms. There's the Iron Condor crowd and different things. There's people playing the VIX roll down. But I think that's right, is there is a steady drip of option selling. Some people are doing it quarterly, some people are doing monthly, some people are doing weeklies, but the steady drip of something near the money, and maybe say like there's 1,000 or 10,000 registered investment advisors out there that whose clients own Apple, and he sells the $5 out of the money call every monthly call on Apple. And when the market sort of calms down and you put that drip of volatility selling supply in whatever form to it, it's hard for the dealers, I think, to realize that. So what do they do? I think the natural reaction is say, well, I got to sell something. I'm going to sell. There's always a bid for that 3-month, 5% out of the money SPX put. Or I can always move a lot of Vega in the VIX and play that roll down. And so I think some of the structural element results in that. If the market's moving around, I don't think you get the congregation of supply. We seem to have settled a couple times for markets do this sometimes, kind of like the euro seems to be stuck at 110. It finds a big number. So the S&P gets stuck at 2,800 or 2,900 or 3,000 or 3,100. And if it sits there for 3-4 weeks and that drip of supply and the market's not moving, I think the dealers do what comes natural. They say, well, I'm going to sell what's bid. So I'm going to sell that out of the money put where there's always a bid for it, or I'm going to move the VIX. But I think that then sets up, remember your sensitivity analysis slides that say, okay, well, that's great. But now it doesn't take very much of a move. You get a 2% move down in the S&P or a 3% move down. And you say, well, that's not really a big move. But all of a sudden you move away from that bolus of option supply that say at 3,100 moved to 3,000, and all of a sudden the dealers go, ooh, I'm still short those VIX futures. That Vega didn't go away. So you deriv out of it. And I think that's part of the reason why you see the VIX has become more spiky, or I think you would call it fragility. It's just a simple move where the dealers are spreading and they're forced to now cover. So you'll see the VIX pop from 13 to 19 on a 2% down move. And you're like, wow, a substantial bounce for a not very large move in the underlying.
You alluded to a little bit of the work that your current firm, DGV, does on behalf of its clients. You talked a little bit about put selling. Talk about the formation of your company, when you founded it, what your mission is, and some of the work that you're doing these days on behalf of your clients.
Yeah. So my career, 10 years on the street market making, whether it was proprietary market making at O'Connor or franchise market making at Swiss Bank. And there's an element of prop trading to that, right? You're effectively positioning Greeks in a way. And then 12 years doing this bottoms up hedge fund work, generally relative value type strategies. And then I had a career pivot. I went to work for a consulting firm here in the Twin Cities, and our clients were institutions. So college endowments, large charitable foundations, hospital systems, insurance companies, retirement plans, and it had a profound impact on me. You know, you go from being in the markets, having a profit motive, sort of living by the rule of the jungle and trying to figure out how to make the best risk-adjusted returns possible, and then becoming a fiduciary for mostly these nonprofits that have these tremendous missions, providing healthcare in their communities, providing scholarships to students or professorships, or the charitable foundations have their own specific missions, et cetera, and helping them with asset allocation and manager selection and things like that. And coming off of this view, we closed down our hedge fund Interlock, and returns were good for the time that we were doing it, but I just didn't see the go forward. Once you got the credit recovery coming out of the crisis, and you just said the funding mechanism was screwed up, so that municipal bond arbitrage trade that we used to deploy could no longer fund it. Munis went from funding at Fed funds less 50 to LIBOR plus 400. There's not a way to make money in munis with that kind of funding rate. So thinking of that relative value hedge fund trade had become a low to mid single digits exercise. Going to this advisory firm, which is now part of Mercer, and working with these clients and understanding the really positive mission that they have had an impact on me. And then going out and talking to managers and saying, gosh, there's a lot of things here that can we do more cheaply, more simply, more liquid, that. And so that was the genesis of DGV. Was, if you look at, give a simple example, you have the SIBO put right index. And if you look at that going back to its inception, it's effectively done S&P 500 returns with 2/3 of the volatility. And you plug that into a mean variance model and it will say, yes, we love those equity-like returns and it's lower vol. The model unconstrained would push capital in that direction. So that was the initial thing we did. And then over time, as things have evolved and we talked to more clients, is providing other sort of systematic exposures for them, be it overlay hedges, FX overlays, rebalancing activity, any specific things that come along, is how it's evolved. And it's great. I mean, we feel kind of a strong sense of mission working with those clients and trying to be a trusted partner to them and do things at a very reasonable cost. We don't charge $2 and $20 for any of our strategies by or anything close to that for that matter.
It's wonderful to hear that and to be driven by a larger mission and to be able to use the expertise that's hard to come by to help folks achieve what they are setting out to do and to be stewards of their capital. And it got me thinking, I've been thinking about this a little bit, and I'd love to just get your thoughts. It's not to predict the future, but it does seem to me that we are in an unstable time relative to the stability of asset prices. You know, we've got low vols, low rates, just low compensation for uncertainty. It's a reasonably consistent theme. You and I were talking about FX vol, which is at a near all-time low. These other metrics are quite thin as well. But if you're in a pension fund or an endowment, this is the environment in which they have to put their capital to work. It's impossible not to be invested. And yet it does feel like at some point we could encounter a reasonably significant disruption to asset prices. How does an institution like a pension fund or an endowment or a hospital, how do they balance these things? It would be quite unfortunate to see a significant risk off, to lose hard-fought gains over the last decade post the crisis. What's the balance between being in the markets and then maintaining some sense of defense as well?
One of the things I think you have to be really cautious of is, this is sort of like a behavioral bias that humans have, is they look at the past and they extrapolate it into the future in either direction. In bull markets, they think they're going to go on forever. And in bear markets, they think they're going to go on forever. I think one of the really important things with some of the clients, and I sit on a number of investment committee boards for large institutions as well, is when you see capital flowing the way it has to certain areas of the market, and I think the poster child is private capital these days. And it's not just venture capital and growth equity, it's private equity and it's private debt. And look at the pricing that's going on there is kind of your empirical evidence of what happened. So you look back over the last 20 years and you say, okay, well, the median private equity fund did 500 basis points better than public markets. So let's just say if the S&P did 9 and private equity funds did 14, but you're already seeing that if you look at higher frequency data, say from Preqin or something, you're already seeing the median private equity fund has been trailing public markets for the last sort of 5 to 10 years. It reminds me a lot of that bolus of capital that hit convert arbitrage and the relative value funds in the 2001 to 2006 period. And that was a disappointing outcome, I think, if you looked at the last decade for those types of funds. And taking nothing away from, there's a handful of really great funds out there, but the average, I think, has probably been disappointed. I think if you said in 2009 to an institution that your diversified, low beta hedge fund bucket was going to give you a 3 to 4% annualized return for the next decade, they'd probably go like, I was hoping for more, or I was expecting more. And so I think that's something you have to be really careful of, is there's so much capital that flowing into these private capital structures, and mostly say private equity, where there's whatever, $2 or $3 trillion of dry powder, and they've driven up multiples from 6x EBITDA 20 years ago to 11.5x today. I don't know if it ends up in a crisis, a disaster. It may just be disappointing, kind of like the hedge fund thing turned out to be disappointing, where you end up with low single digits or mid single digit returns, and you've locked your money up for 10 years. But it's created this knock-on effect of those private equity guys want to put debt on. So that's created demand for unitranche loans and direct lending strategies. So you look at the growth in that. It also feeds a self-fulfilling prophecy to a degree, coming back to that late 1990s analogy. Remember, you had all these dot-coms starting up and they all had to buy Cisco equipment. And it, so it fed some of the big, you know, the picks and shovels of the internet for a period of time until that capital dried up. And I think you see that now. There's a lot of money flowing in, and WeWork has become the poster child of when that business model gets found out to not be what you thought it was, all of a sudden you say, okay, where are my cash flows? What have I got here? And I think you could see kind of a reckoning there where it was just growth at all costs. We're going to keep fueling this beast with more and more capital to try to grow the top line. You're not sure the business model works. So I think in a static where interest rates, credit spreads, and thus debt service costs stay where they are, and those cash flows come through, there's not a bad arbitrage. You buy something at 11.5 times EBITDA, so let's just say it's a 8.5% cash flow yield in round numbers, and you say, well, I can borrow money from one of these direct lenders at 5.5 or 6, and I put 5 turns of leverage on it. I can get my gross return up into the high teens. I charge a boatload of fees, and my net returns come down to low double digits, and that works. I think where you get upset is debt service cost goes up for some reason, spreads rise, rates rise, or your EBITDA isn't stable. So you get a recession or you get idiosyncratic blowups, and then you've got a problem because now you've got a company with 5 turns of leverage on it that's can't service its debt. So I think that's one of the big forward-looking risks.
So much of it comes down to the trajectory of growth and inflation. Too much inflation and hard to surmise for a lot of folks, but as you point to US CPI 2.3%, it's not nothing, but it is hard to paint a picture of much higher inflation. But if the Fed were behind the curve and trying to stave off what it was in its mind was uncomfortably high inflation, that certainly could be disruptive. And then the other side, just as you say, a lot of the positioning presupposes sunny days ahead for economic growth and corporate profits. And that's been the case for a long time. It just forever is a long time too. So I think one of the risks that people seem to point to is if you stipulate that growth and let's say profits have come down, a lot of the assumptions around which some of the debt structures are built will not look favorable very quickly. So that would be one risk. Yeah. Well, John, I want to thank you. This has been an awesome conversation. It was really great to catch up, especially hearing about the early days of FX vol pre-Euro was really interesting. And just your overall insights on the landscape of vol and risk premia. I'm really thankful we had this conversation.
Thanks, Dean. I really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to the Alpha Exchange. If you've enjoyed the show, please do tell a friend. And before we leave, I wanted to invite you to drop us some feedback. As we aim to utilize these conversations to contribute to the investment community's understanding of risk, your input is valuable and provides direction on where we should focus. Please email us at feedback@alphaexchangepodcast.com. Thanks again and catch you next time.